Dear colleagues, dear friends, it is my special pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker of this afternoon, the first female Secretary of State of the United States of America, present at the creation of the 1999 strategic concept, former United Nations ambassador as well. And if you knew about her schedule, what I know, what's going to follow her appearance in our midst this afternoon, you would definitely not have the impression, and that's the impression we'll all have, that Madam Secretary, Madeleine Albright, will ever retire. But Madam Secretary, it is a great and special pleasure to have you in our midst, and it is a pleasure to ask you to take the floor.
Mr. Secretary General, thank you so much for that introduction, and I'm delighted to be here, Mr. Secretary General Designate, and Excellencies, and special guests. It's wonderful to be here on this afternoon. This is such a distinguished audience, I can only conclude that Atlanticism is alive and well. And I really would like to begin by thanking the Secretary General for inviting me, and also congratulate him for his years of outstanding leadership. Mr. Secretary General, you have guided this organization brilliantly and will leave to your successor an alliance that is strong, cohesive, and as central to global security as it has ever been. The world owes you a debt, and I hope that in years to come, you will continue to share your wisdom with all of us. When I was Secretary of State, I often came to Brussels to present the official policy recommendations of my government. And today I am here in an unofficial capacity, but my enthusiasm could not be greater, for NATO has always been very much a part of my life. Its birth was hastened by the communist takeover in 1948 of my native country of Czechoslovakia. From then until the fall of the Berlin Wall, NATO had the dual role of shielding freedom in the West while preserving hope in Europe's East. And as a daughter of Prague living in America, I had one foot on each side of the divide. A decade ago, I had the privilege of welcoming Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic into our alliance, and of working with many of you to end the terror and ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. As these events reflect, NATO has been the most successful alliance in history. As current events dictate, it remains a preeminent actor on the world stage. So I'm delighted to join with you in launching an effort to revise and update NATO's strategic concept. Our goal should be a statement whose message is clear to audiences both within and outside the alliance, a text that will serve equally as an internal guide and as a constructive signal to people of all ages and cultures around the world. We begin that task with the wind at our backs. In many of our now 28 capitals, there's a fresh commitment to the success and vigil and vigor of our alliance. In Washington, a new administration is emphasizing a comprehensive and collaborative approach to human security with NATO at its core. The French have sent a powerful message of support by rejoining NATO's military command. And as was evident during the summit in Strasbourg-Kehl, alliance members are in general agreement about NATO's primary missions and international role. Each ally is committed to an enduring transatlantic link, and each supports the doctrine of collective defense, and each understands the need for adaptation, and each believes in our partnerships, and each is dedicated to NATO's values. Drafting a new strategic concept, therefore, is less a question of reinvention than of refinement. We have a firm foundation upon which to build. This does not mean that our job will be easy or that NATO's future is assured. Almost 20 years after the breakup of the Soviet Union, our alliance is still in the process of adjusting. The Cold War was bitter, but also fairly stable, with relations kept in place by an iron curtain and a concrete wall. Today, political dynamics are more fluid, and so are the dangers. Serious threats emanate from viral ideologies, failed states, irresponsible leaders, dangerous technologies, and environmental neglect. This toxic blend demands a multifaceted response. The NATO of the 21st century must combine political wisdom with military clout and diplomatic skills. It must be versatile and adept at preventive action, and it must be counted on to deliver whenever Euro-Atlantic security is on the line. These imperatives should guide the day-to-day management of our alliance. They should inform the budget and policy decisions of each alliance member, and they should be at the heart of NATO's new strategic concept. In drafting that document, we might remind ourselves that NATO has never defined its purpose in terms of what we are against. From the very beginning, we have described our common agenda in positive terms: to safeguard freedom, promote stability, uphold the principles of democracy, and to extend the rule of law. These objectives are not tied to any calendar, nor are they dependent on any particular adversary. They will survive as long as we have the courage to defend them, but defend them we must, for in the future, as in the past, our interests and ideals will surely be opposed. It's no secret that Al-Qaeda and its allies have made themselves the enemy of all who value human dignity and life. Their attacks have triggered a worldwide confrontation marked by incidents of outrage from New York and Istanbul to Moscow and Madrid, and from the Horn of Africa to the London Underground. But if there is a center to this struggle, it is in Afghanistan, spilling over into Pakistan's fiercely independent western frontier. And that's why it matters so much that each alliance member do all it can to support NATO's mission in that part of the world. The good news is that the Afghan people know what living under the Taliban is like and do not wish to repeat that experience. But to capitalize on that, Afghanistan's government must provide an effective alternative. Through its presence and by its training, NATO can help the country's legitimate leaders to provide the security and the opportunity their people so desperately need. If we're patient in our approach and wise in our strategy, we can improve the prospects for stability in Afghanistan and throughout the region. But if we grow frustrated or fail to make a maximum effort, we may witness the rise of yet another generation of terrorists and see a nuclear-armed Pakistan pushed to the brink. Elsewhere around the world, NATO must cope with the danger posed by nuclear activities occurring outside the safeguards established by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea and Iran especially merit our concern. Few developments would be more troubling than the emergence of new nuclear weapon states. A three-part response is required. First, our alliance should insist that nuclear programs be legal and consistent with a stable and peaceful world order. Second, we should be vigilant in protecting our people from the possible misuse of advanced weapons and missile technologies. And third, we should be united in our support for arms control and for a future in which nuclear weapons play an ever-diminishing security role. A further source of 21st century danger is one painfully familiar to students of history, and that is cross-border military aggression. Although such incidents may occur less frequently now than at times in the past, there will always be some governments that are tempted to intervene in the affairs of neighboring states. NATO's core purpose has been and must remain to make attacks against its own members unthinkable. We should also work through the United Nations to see that in any place at any time, aggression does not pay. Finally, there exists a viper's nest of additional dangers, some originating with states, others with groups or even individuals. And these include cyber sabotage, biological and chemical contamination, organized crime, and piracy. Each is a threat to world order, and each places new demands on the capabilities of our alliance. and each requires fresh thinking about how to adapt and apply NATO resources to cope with diverse problems. In planning for the future, we must bear in mind that although NATO is a leader, it must also be a partner. As we have learned in recent years, most security crises have political, economic, social, and sometimes religious dimensions. An effective response may therefore depend on a pooling of talent and a sharing of tasks. Our strategic concept must recognize that NATO's work will often rely on a comprehensive approach involving cooperation with other parts of the international system, including the UN in all its aspects, the EU, the OSCE, the African Union, and other regional organizations and major non-governmental organizations. Alliance operations will also be influenced by NATO's global standing. It matters how our efforts are viewed in such capitals as Delhi and Islamabad and Pretoria and Cairo, Brasilia and Beijing. We cannot simply assume that our intentions will be understood correctly, especially in parts of the world that have hostile or mixed feelings towards the West. The NATO story is a proud one, and even glorious, but it has grown more complex as new chapters have been written. Each year, across the globe, there are fewer people who recall NATO's creation, fewer who remember its Cold War resolve, and fewer who have a clear sense of why NATO's survival and success should matter to them. So as we think about our strategic concept, we should bear in mind how such a document will be read, not only within the Euro-Atlantic community, but in every region. And as we prepare to implement that concept, we must include a plan for explaining our policies and our actions persuasively and in real time, making full use of modern information technology. We're in this room today because we believe in the ongoing importance of NATO's mission. But our challenge is to reach and to teach the billions of people who are not in this room. We must convince them that even while protecting the rights of alliance members, NATO will uphold the rights of all. To illustrate that truth, we must back our words with actions, but we must also be wise in the words that we choose. The original North Atlantic Treaty consisted of 23 sentences. Our current strategic concept has 65 paragraphs. If we want NATO's purpose to be understood, we must speak in language that average people can actually understand. Clear writing is a reflection of clear thinking, and clear thinking is indispensable to NATO's future. Of course, much of our thinking in recent times has focused on the scope of NATO's activities and missions. A consensus exists that to protect our interests, we must sometimes act outside our borders, as we have done in the Balkans and as we are doing now in Afghanistan and through our maritime operations. Some suggest that these external missions have opened a fault line within the alliance, placing on one side those who believe that NATO should assume the role of global police, and on the other, those who insist that NATO stay close to home. In truth, I see no such fault line, but instead a sensible search for a reasonable balance. There are limits to what NATO can do and also to what we should attempt. We are a regionally based security alliance and cannot be all things to all people. And at the same time, we must not settle for the role of turtle hiding in our shell while external dangers flourish. Article 5 and collective defense remain properly the cornerstone of our alliance. However, we must also be prepared to respond to threats that arise beyond our territory, taking into account the urgency of those threats, the availability of other security options, and the likely consequences of acting or of failing to act. We are a defensive alliance, but we cannot afford to be a passive one. A similar sense of balance is necessary when contemplating another potential source of division within NATO, and that's Russia. President Obama is in Moscow, and if you've all watched the news, he has had a remarkable meeting, not only with President Medvedev, but with Prime Minister Putin, and has just delivered a great speech. On both sides, there are expectations mixed with uncertainty. Russia and the Euro-Atlantic community have an armful of shared interests, but we also have a handful of significant differences. And that's why our strategic concept must be flexible enough to embrace Russia as a partner and firm enough to hold the Kremlin to its obligations. Ultimately, only Russia can define Russia, just as only NATO can define NATO. Our alliance must make decisions about future members based on qualifications alone, neither asserting nor recognizing a sphere of influence, neither opposing nor appeasing the government of any other country. No nation can dictate to another what alliance that country may or may not join. When I was Secretary of State, we agreed then, when discussing security in Europe, that Russia was entitled to a voice, but not a veto. And I believe that principle still applies. Years ago, during the Cold War, NATO's main objective was to defend freedom from the threat of aggression by the communist bloc. When the Berlin Wall fell, we set our sights on a Euro-Atlantic community that was whole and free. And today, we understand that neither the defeat of communism nor our own freedom is sufficient to guarantee security. NATO must strive for a world in which differences are resolved without violence, where people are allowed to live without fear of aggression or attack, and in which the rule of law is legitimately constituted, broadly recognized, and widely enforced. By its nature, this is an enterprise to be waged on many fronts, simultaneously and continuously. And it will lead not to some climactic or universal triumph, but to the hope that our children can grow up in a world more peaceful, free, and humane than it has been. And for that to happen, NATO must operate in the future with all the energy and focus it has shown in the past. And each member of the alliance must meet its obligations fully and without fail. Looking back, we can see that many of the threats we faced in the past have vanished or shifted in shape. And looking ahead, we can expect that many of the problems we worry about today will also wax or wane. Global and regional dangers must naturally command NATO's attention, but these impermanent perils must never define our alliance. In 1949, we came together not because we were afraid, but because of our faith in the values of democracy, free expression, and respect for the dignity of every human being. And we have learned since that our organization must constantly adapt to the demands of political and technological change. But we have also learned what must not change. NATO's strategic concept must begin and end with NATO's founding ideals. And just as surely, NATO's future will depend on its unity. Years ago, Thucydides wrote that the Peloponnesians and their allies were powerful in battle, but handicapped by political divisions. Each pressed for its own agenda, each thinking that others would act in time to preserve the common cause. But because each operated under the same illusion, the alliance soon forgot its purpose and was ruined. This must not happen to NATO. The world remains too dangerous, and the role of our alliance too vital, and our shared vision of the world remains too important for us to lose our way now. So let's begin the task of charting NATO's future with confident hearts, bearing in mind our responsibility to those who preceded us and to all who are among us and to future generations. Thank you all very much, and I now look forward to having a discussion. Thank you.
I could stand here.
What would you like me to stand here?
Okay. Madam Secretary, thank you very much. And Secretary Albright said, she's willing to take questions. So the shorter the question, the more we can have. So I first of all go over there, please. And there should be a microphone. Would you please stand and, as always, give your name and affiliation?
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm Miranda Calha from Portugal and member of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And I congratulate, first of all, Madeleine Albright for your conference and for your clear idea about the evolution of our alliance, our NATO. But I would like to put you two questions. Of course, that we know after the last concept that there are two facts that are major facts the last 10 years. One was 9/11, and one was the operation out of area in Afghanistan. And I think that these two facts create the idea of a movement to change a concept that, nevertheless, is a concept that it was useful and is, of course, up to date now. But the questions are these. First of all, about the evolution of enlargement. We know this is linked to the treaty, and we know that this is linked also to fifth article. And we think about less facts that happen in the world, and in the some areas, Georgia and Ukraine, that had occurred last year.
Sir, could I ask you to please get to your question, please, if you don't
yes,
mind.
Yes, and the question is, what is your idea about that evolution of enlargement? To where can we go? And about out-of-area operations, it's the same questions. To where do we go? Because we have an operation far east in Afghanistan, but to where can we go? To where is our possibility to act? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Secretary.
Thank you. Well, I do think both of those are very basic questions that the new strategic concept has to focus on. My own personal views, and let me say I speak for no one, and one of the best parts about no longer being Secretary of State is I can actually answer your question. So, I believe that NATO enlargement has to continue to be a dynamic process. But having been there when we first started talking about the Partnership for Peace, for instance, and General Shalikashvili and I were going through every country in Central and Eastern Europe, we made very clear that NATO was not a charitable organization, that what you had to do was to be ready to contribute to NATO and to be a responsible member and the defense budget to reflect it and also the political system to reflect it. And I think we need to keep that in mind. We aren't just going to take members just because they are located somewhere. They have to fulfill the responsibilities of NATO. But I believe that we need to continue to be a dynamic process and that countries should be capable and allowed to join whatever alliance they want. Nobody can be told to join what alliance, whatever alliance. So that is my view. I also, having been, I have the rather, what I consider honor to have been a Secretary of State who actually worked to take NATO to war, and in fact to save people's lives both in Bosnia and Kosovo, out of area. And I think that we have to look at these things case by case to see to what how they affect us as an alliance in our terms of our national interests. But also, I do believe, as I said in my remarks, that there are other organizations that we need to cooperate with, and that I would hope that we would not see competition, but more cooperation among different organizations that also can develop a military capability. But I think these are the very, you've asked very basic questions that I think are what exactly is going to be being considered.
Thank you. Now, next question, sir.
Yes, Nuno Roger from Portugal, Euro-Atlantic Institute. You spoke about the Cold War and your memories of the Czech massacre and destruction. Do you believe that in our relationship with Russia these days, we have a commonality of values? I'm asking you that because immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, we heard from Moscow that they were also liberated with that fall. So the Yeltsin era spoke about the fall of the Soviet Union as a liberation of the Russian people also. We don't hear that so much from Moscow, I don't know. You think that we have common values in what regards the past and the positive elements of an alliance? That's the first question. Second one...
Can we keep it a one question, yeah, please, sir? Because then yeah. Other people will have the opportunity right. to ask
okay.
questions
okay.
too.
Okay.
So one question only, and okay. that it's been asked. Madam Secretary.
I think that we have some common values in terms of trying to see how people can live in peace and security, trying to help the economic situation of our countries. Also, I think, trying to prevent various regional disputes. We might not agree on everything. I do think, and I take my text from what President Obama did today, I think we have common values in lowering the number of nuclear arms. I think that has been a significant aspect out of this particular summit. I think, though, that we are at a phase where we need to understand what is going on in Russia. And I have to say this in front of all of you, that I don't buy the revisionist aspect, which says that we took advantage of a weak Russia to enlarge NATO. I personally spoke to President Yeltsin and said to him, you do not, he said, we have a new Russia. And I said, yeah, we have a new NATO, and this is not against you. And at some point, you may, in fact, wish to be a part of this. So I don't buy this fact that we didn't respect them, spent a lot of time trying to respect Russia, believe me. So I think that they are going through a phase now where President Putin, Prime Minister Putin, and President Medvedev have a certain set of needs that they have. But I think, as President Obama said, there are, in fact, common values and common interests, and we need to seek those and say very plainly when we disagree. President Obama did today on Georgia, Ukraine, and said basically that they could, as I had said, had the opportunity to choose whatever alliance they want to be in. But I think it's worth it to us to find the commonalities with Russia. I think that is an important aspect of what our work needs to be. And I'm very glad to see that the Russia-NATO Council has been revived.
Thank you. A question from the gentleman over there.
Thank you very much. My name is Otto Hieronymi. I'm a former Hungarian refugee from 56. I'm an American citizen. I live in Switzerland, a neutral country. I would like to, first of all, congratulate the NATO Secretary for this conference, because I think it's also a demonstration of democracy. Having said this, I would like to raise a question, maybe a little bit of, out of place. What about Japan? All day today, we have not heard a single time Japan mentioned. And obviously, NATO is both a security organization and the political organization. And the three pillars of the Western community, the strongest one, are US, Europe, and Japan. And obviously, for the US, Japan is the most important ally in Asia. And it seems to me that Europeans and Japanese should understand that this cannot be just Euro-Atlantic and Japan-US at the time when we have global security and global threats. I would be interested in your reaction to this.
Well, I think you make a very, very important point. The United States especially has an alliance with Japan. We consider our relationship with Japan one of the key relationships in one of the, not just in Asia, but in a variety of ways. And I think that it is possible, and I would hope that as we think about the next years, that we understand the potential relationships. What is interesting is we did develop a designation for a number of countries of being a non-NATO ally and finding ways to have closer relationships. And I think what we need to do is to really look at what are the other strategic relationships and to go back to a common value question where, in fact, there are common values and common interests, because as we look at various issues throughout the world, they're going to be essential. And you look at, I know, you've all talked about some of this already, but there are issues on environmental issues, on bioterrorism, on energy issues that require much broader relationships than just specifically. But I think those are, it's possible to be a member and then also develop partners.
Thank you. Ambassador Scarpa, please.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Secretary, for a very inspiring introduction. You mentioned in the beginning that Atlanticism is alive and well, as this meeting showed. I wonder if you could say a bit more about the state of play of Atlanticism in the United States itself. A couple of years ago, you could hear from people in Washington and elsewhere, Atlanticists were a kind of minority group becoming more and more irrelevant. Now, clearly, with the new Obama administration, multilateralism is back high on the agenda. But particularly now, Atlanticism, how strong is that in your feeling at the moment in the U.S.?
I think that what you see with President Obama is a very specific modus operandi, which is a recognition of the issues that are out there for the 21st century that require cooperation, whether it's arms control or fighting terrorism or dealing with the environmental energy issues or food supplies or terror, whatever. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out you need partners for it. And I do think that in the various speeches that the president's already made, he does something that I really admire, which is that he says, we have done X wrong, but so have you. It is, one, it bears the validity of being true, and second, I think it inspires people to understand that we need to look at our own behavior. I do think that the U.S. seeks a partnership with Europe, Atlanticism, because we do share more in terms of values and interests than with any other part of the world, but it does require more cooperation from Europe. I think that there is this sense of you Europeans want to be consulted, which is great, but there is another side to that, which means then you have to actually contribute. So I do think that there is a regrowth of Atlanticism and a sense of that natural partnership, but it needs to be worked on. And there was always this kind of, you know, in the last 8 years, people talked about that Europeans were from Venus and Americans were from Mars, but I think people forgot their mythology, which is that Venus and Mars actually got along pretty well, and they had some children whose names were Concordia and Harmony. So, you know, we can use mythology.
Madam Secretary, could you take two?
Happily,
more?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take two more. Thank you very much for giving us your time. Dan Kosky, have I got you right, Dan? Because I can see you via your tie, which stands out in the dark.
The very purpose of it. Daniel Kosky from the European Council on Foreign Relations. And I should say, the child of refugees from Poland, to pick up on previous speakers. Madam Secretary, for a lot of people, the alliance seems divided at least into three. Sort of Article 5ers who fret about Russia, stabilizers who think about expeditionary operations as the alliance's modus operandi, and a sort of third group that hides in between and doesn't want to get involved in anything. And none of the three groups seem to be investing in the civilian capabilities required for most kind of contingencies. Now, how do we practically overcome this tripartite division?
I think that you state that really well in a way that is going to require more thinking, because actually what is happening is that we are finding, while NATO is the premier military alliance of all time, that many of the activities that it has to be involved in have a civilian component. But that's true. We're finding that with the American military, or people are finding it various UN peacekeeping operations, that they require that extra depth. And I do think this is one of the things that we all have to look at, a more, when I talk about comprehensive, not only laterally in trying to find different partners, but also vertically of trying to look at what the various roles are. Expeditionary is great, I think, but it's not enough if you aren't helping developing some infrastructure and then working on, you know, for want of a better word, hearts and minds, and trying to provide some educational capacity. And so that civic part. People ask me what I think I did wrong as secretary. I basically had too many priorities, which is like saying on your resume, I work too hard. But the bottom line is that my tendency is to try to use organizations in a way that develop their capacity, because there is so much to do. But I think the way you set up that tripart division is a very useful way to begin to think about it.
Thank you. And then the final question goes to Espen Barthaide. I'm sorry to everybody else, but it has to be the last question. Espen, over to you.
Thank you very much, Madam Secretary, for an extremely inspiring speech, which makes me very optimistic about the work we're just embarking on here now. And my short but I think important question is about our relative role as NATO in the work that's being done on nuclear disarmament. Because many of us are very heartened by the positive tones that are coming out of Moscow and the new initiatives of President Obama to really deal with this issue. We were reminded by Mr. El-Baradei earlier today about our own role in this very important global quest. And what is it in this for NATO? What can NATO do to help? And how can we make sure that we do not inadvertently end up standing in the way of the initiatives that are being taken by President Obama and President Medvedev?
Well, I think clearly NATO has a very large role, one in making clear how the numbers can be achieved. But also, I think, at least from my own look at things, this is not going to remain an issue just on nuclear arms, but we'll ultimately get into questions of conventional forces and a whole host of issues to do with how the relationship evolves. And I think that we need to look more specifically, because we do have, as NATO, a responsibility and to work on the not only the what I think is kind of an initial cut at the numbers, but the beginning of a very strategic discussion on it, which obviously NATO has to be involved in. Let me just say this. I am always introduced as the first female Secretary of State. But I was also the last Secretary of State of the 20th century and the first of the 21st. And the issue was, the only problem with that statement was I started saying it kind of 6 months after President Clinton appointed me, which was rather presumptuous, because it made it sound as if I knew I was going to stay. I did, and so I am. And the reason I say that is that one of the things we were trying to do was to begin to develop the organizations for the 21st century. I don't know how many of you would listen to President Clinton regularly, but he was constantly building a bridge to the 21st century. And I think that here, I don't think enough work has been done in the last 8 years to think about institutional structures for the 21st century. A lot has to be done. And I think, obviously, NATO and a strategic concept is very much a part of what has to happen as we move into what could be a great century, but did not start very well. So I think we have a big job, and I thank you so much for having invited me.
Secretary Albright, many thanks indeed. As far as this audience is concerned, you could stay forever. And certainly you'll be the first person we're going to invite back in 2019 when we do the next strategic concept. But thank you so much indeed for flying the Atlantic just to be with us. It's great to have you with us. Thank you.